thank Philadelphia Society for setting up their fall meeting devoted to larger cultural themes in general and to the figure of Russell Kirk in particular. Russell Kirk devoted his career to reminding Americans of the great traditions our nation is founded on. Although he concentrated on English traditions in such books as The Conservative Mind, published in 1953, and America's British Culture, published 40 years later, he also appreciated and wrote on America's biblical and classical traditions, The Roots of American Order in 1974, and the appendix to America's British Culture, entitled What Did Americans Inherit from the Ancients? The alternative view that America's founders rejected the past and that our founding is rooted in the 18th century French or sometimes Scottish Enlightenment with a few 17th century predecessors is widely held today and was first proclaimed by Europeans at the time of the nation's founding. In 1782, the French immigrant Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur described Americans as rejecting tradition and embracing novelty in his letters from an American farmer. He asked the question, quote, what then is the American, this new man, end quote. And he went on to answer, quotes, he is an American who, leaving behind him all his ancient prejudices and manners, receives new ones, the new mode of life he has embraced, the new government he obeys, and the new rank he holds. Crèvecoeur's vision was still alive and well 220 years later at the conclusion of Dinesh D'Souza's What's So Great About America? Done with math in your head, published 2002. D'Souza writes, quotes, as the American founders knew, America is a new kind of society that produces a new kind of human being. That human being, confident, self-reliant, tolerant, generous, future-oriented, is a vast improvement over the wretched, servile, fatalistic, and intolerant human being that traditional societies have always produced and that Islamic societies produce now, end quotes. I'd say something intolerant, but I'm too servile. It's not only enthusiastic immigrants who talk this way. John Andrews, the past president of the Colorado Senate, wrote in his regular column for the Denver Post on June 20th, 2008, quotes, the old world is just that old. Coloradans pride themselves on a state capital from the century before last. Our nephew in Bristol, England, showed us a cathedral from the millennium before last. He's a scholar studying what he called the relatively recent Latin writings of St. Hildegard, who wrote 900 years ago, Europe's air is thick with the weight of the past, end quotes. John Andrews is quite correct. Bristol Cathedral was begun more than 700 years before the Colorado State Capitol. On the other hand, the medieval English Christians who constructed Bristol Cathedral over the centuries consistently did so in the latest style, first Romanesque or Norman, and later, and for the most part, Gothic. The style 19th century Coloradans chose for their state capital was classic, modeled on ancient Roman buildings some 2,000 years old. I see your millennium, John, and raise you a millennium. It was the favorite style of the early Republic, as Charles and Mary Beard wrote in their wonderful college textbook, Rise of American Civilization, about the early Republic, quotes, it was with the mind fixed upon the imposing designs of ancient city planners that Major L'Enfant conceived his elaborate scheme for the city of Washington. When in 1808 the adopted son of Washington built his mansion in Arlington, Virginia, he seemed convinced that the final triumph of art lay in the achievements of Greeks 2,000 years in their tombs. It was to the simplicity, solemnity, and power of Rome, the spoiler of Greece, that Jefferson turned from the design of his University of Virginia. In the same reverence for classical antiquity, the colonial Georgian style of the 18th century was now pushed aside by architects who built mansions to southern planters, banks, offices for the federal government, and the capital to house the Congress of the United States. End quote. Americans wanted to live and work in classical buildings because their tastes had been shaped by their classical education. In a word, they were classical traditionalists. This is the fundamental difference between 17th and 18th century Whigs and the liberals who came from the Enlightenment tradition of anti-traditionalism, to use Alistair MacIntyre's phrase. Enlightenment thinkers and activists see their mission as freeing their generation from the dead hand of the past. Whigs, like our founders, recognize that the past is the source of beauty, freedom, and wisdom. What confuses some people is the fact that America's traditionalist founders in the second half of the 18th century were contemporaries of the radical philosopher of the French Enlightenment. In 1825, Henry Lee questioned the originality of the Declaration of Independence and wrote to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson responded by denying that he was attempting to be original. About the Declaration, he wrote, quotes, "It was intended to be an expression of the American mind," end quotes. It's one of the most popular quotes from Jefferson. You hear it mentioned again and again. The interesting thing is Jefferson explained what he meant by that, and that explanation is hardly ever quoted. He went on to write, quotes, "It was intended to be an expression of the American mind. All its authority rests, then, on the harmonizing sentiments of the day." Harmonizing sentiments are what we now call consensus. "Whether expressed in conversation, in letters, printed essays, or in the elementary books of public right," as Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc., quotes. Most Jeffersons simply ignore Jefferson's testimony. A few refuse to credit it. Name one of our favorite colleagues, James R. Stoner, writing in ISI's Intercollegiate Review for 2005, wrote, quotes, "The theoretical paragraph of the Declaration," he means the preamble, quotes, "the theoretical paragraph of the Declaration sketches a political doctrine that today we recognize as classically liberal." In contradistinction, I might add, despite Jefferson's claim to Aristotle's teaching, end quotes. Gary Wills, in Inventing America, is impatient at Jefferson's, quotes, "crediting Aristotle of all people with formation of the background for his declaration," end quotes. Several colonial activists confirm Jefferson's recollection. Jonathan Mayhew said in his 1766 sermon on the repeal of the Stamp Act, quotes, "having been initiated in youth in the doctrines of civil liberty, as they were taught by such men as Plato, Demosthenes, and Cicero, and other renowned persons among the ancients, and such as Sidney and Milton, Locke and Hoadley, and the moderns, I liked them. They seemed rational," end quotes. 1775, John Adams wrote to a Tory opponent who had mocked the principles later found in the Declaration's preamble, quotes, "These are what are called revolution principles. They're the principles of Aristotle and Plato, Livy and Cicero, Sidney, Arrington, and Locke, the principles of nature and eternal reason," end quotes. The colonists' views were shaped by their classical Christian education. They learned Greek and Latin, they studied the ancient republics, and they read Cicero and Virgil. Jefferson traced the self-evident truths of the Declaration, which he called an expression of the American mind, back to Aristotle and Cicero. Mayhew and Adams found the doctrines of civil liberty and the principles of nature and eternal reason in great writers of classical antiquity. George Washington was unusual among the founders in not receiving a classical education, but in his public life, he surrounded himself with men who had. As in private life, he made sure that his stepson, Jeff Custis, studied and loved the classics. David Biederman writes in his excellent book on the classical foundations of the American Constitution, quotes, "It would be easy to dismiss the influence of the classical tradition on the framing generation as some peculiar and pretentious residuum of the elite culture of the times. Indeed, in the modern historiography of the intellectual life of the early republic, that is precisely the prevalent view. But classicism was a mere window dressing to the pragmatic, hard-knuckled politics. In this version of the framing mythos, the individuals who act in our national nativity scene read only Enlightenment political literature, speak only in a pragmatic political argo, and think only in terms of class, money, and power. These are, after all, things we comprehend today. In accordance with this view, in the script of the Framing Morality play, veers off into unexpected pieces of dialogue as the framers speak of God's providence and the role of churches in the new society, of classical models of government and republican virtues, our modern internal dramaturge excises the scenes, or worse yet, annotates them as irrelevant. You know, so exactly what's done in Jefferson's reference to Aristotle and Cicero. Most scholars don't even refer to it. The few that do explain to you can't be right. Let me exemplify Biederman's analysis by discussing the framers' deliberations on whether the states should be represented in Congress in proportion to their population, or each state have an equal vote, as in the Articles of Confederation. I follow Jack Rakoff's lively version of the standard account in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book on the making of the Constitution, Original Meanings. For Rakoff, the Constitutional Convention was about practical politics. He writes, quotes, "The convention delegates of 1787-88 came to their task fresh, not from research in their studies, but from the business of managing a revolution and conducting public affairs at every level of government, conscious as they were of the fate of other republics and confederacies, ancient and modern. The lessons of the past they weighed most heavily were drawn from their own experience," end quotes. For Rakoff, this is the Madisonian moment. Quotes, "Madison went to Philadelphia convinced he found a complete remedy for the vices of the American political system," end quotes, "on the basis of his practical political experience. His Virginia plan replaced the one state, one vote assembly of the Articles of Confederation with a bicameral legislature elected on the basis of the population itself, one of three branches of government. Virginia plan seemed to favor the large states at the expense of the small ones by emphasizing population, and provoked James Madison's New Jersey plan, which had three independent branches of government, but preserved a unicameral Congress with each state having one vote. Patterson's plan did not remedy the perceived weaknesses of the Articles and ignored the earlier vote of the convention in favor of a bicameral legislature. On July the 19th, it was voted down 7-3, with one divided. Rakoff points out, the opportunity that now beckoned the large state leaders was to convert this majority into a durable coalition in favor of proportional representation in both houses," end quotes. This they failed to do. Small states suggested proportional representation in one house, with the states maintaining equal vote in the other. At first, they did not fare well. Rakoff notes, time after time, they were battered in debate. The big states were winning. What happened? Let me give Rakoff's own account. On June the 28th, quotes, "after Luther Martin's two-day defense of the immutable sovereignty of the states rambled to a halt," quotes, Madison responded with a brilliant, in fact, he leapt up and responded with a brilliant speech on his theory of faction, which we know from the 10th Federalist. Benjamin Franklin urged delegates to begin each day with prayer, asking the Father of Lights to illuminate our understandings. 2 days later, Madison spoke again. Give his own summary, quotes, "the states are divided into different interests, not by their difference of size, but principally from their having and not having slaves," end quote. As Rakoff saw, if Madison were willing to introduce the divisive issue of slavery, quotes, "it was probably because he sensed the tide of debate was turning against him," end quote. In fact, again Rakoff quotes, "the supporters of the equal state vote grew impervious to appeals for justice, however eloquent," end quotes. "After a tie vote on July the 2nd and July the 16th, a proposal that each state have an equal vote in the Senate, but that bills of appropriation originate in the lower house, was approved, 5-4. What happened between the rejection of the New Jersey plan on June the 10th and June the 19th, and the acceptance of an equal vote in the Senate on July the 16th? Given the frantic activity by Madison and his cohorts at the end of June, including two brilliant speeches by Madison himself and Franklin's plea for daily prayer, seems likely something occurred then. The disinterested statesmen who had rejected the New Jersey plan changed in 1 month into parochial partisans described by Rakoff as impervious to appeals for justice. I suggest that they changed their minds because they'd been persuaded by a speech directly preceding Madison's and Franklin's. which you'll remember they delivered, I quote Jack Rico again, quote, after Luther Martin's two-day defense of the immutable sovereignty of the states rambled to a halt, end quote. Luther Martin spoke for 3 hours on June the 27th and continued on June the 28th, arguing for an equal vote for each state in the Senate. He avoided the issues of self-interest and faction, so dear to the hearts of James Madison and modern historians, and instead expounded the principles of civil liberty as handed down from classical antiquity and formulated by Whig thinkers. His refusal to profit from the personal experience of the past decade enraged James Madison, who refused to record most of the speech. The evidence was that my own earthies too was penned out, put his legs up on the table and glared out the window. The evidence that his influence was decisive is circumstantial but significant. Madison delivered two major speeches in response, trying to refocus the discussion on interest politics. In Bill Kaufman's words in his ISI book on Martin, Martin's two-day stemwinder struck a nerve. The response of Benjamin Franklin's revealing, in my opinion. Before rising to speak, he gave Madison a copy of his remarks, which was far from extemporaneous. We know exactly what he said. He addressed, of course, George Washington. Mr. President, quotes, we indeed seem to feel our want of political wisdom since we've been running about in search of it. We've gone back to ancient history for models of government and examined the different forms of those republics which, having been formed with the seeds of their own disillusion, now no longer exist. And we've viewed modern states all around Europe, but find none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances. In this situation of this assembly, groping, as it were, in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding, end quotes. After some more pious reflections, Franklin moved that delegates invite preachers to begin each day's deliberation with prayer. He was asking the delegates to ignore the principles of free institutions as handed down from antiquity in favor of their own lucubrations. For Franklin, the Father of Lights had more to teach the delegates than the author of history, a figure with whom he is sometimes confused. The delegates' response was significant. As Madison reports, quotes, Mr. Sherman seconded the motion. After several unsuccessful attempts for silently postponing the matter by adjournment, the adjournment was at length carried without any vote on the motion, end quotes. The power of the classical tradition led the framers to deny their most distinguished colleague the courtesy of a vote on his motion. This, however, is not the whole story. Although Madison's notes are usually the fullest, in this case his disgust with Luther Martin led him to ignore a significant point preserved in the laconic jottings of Martin's ally, William Patterson of New Jersey. These are Patterson's notes. Quotes, Amphictyonic Council of Greece, represented by two from each town, who were notwithstanding the disproportion of the towns equal. Collins' Ancient History, Volume 4, page 79. Historian Gilbert Chenard writes, who would have thought that unless such positive texts were produced, that the limitation of two senators for each state might perhaps be traced to the Amphictyonic Council of Greece, end quote. Indeed, the documentary record proves the Amphictyonic League provided the precedent for the idea of two senators from each state. Who can fail to be impressed that this happened in the face of the vigorous objections of James Madison and the weary protests of Benjamin Franklin. Luther Martin not only won the delegates over to preserving an equal vote for each state, they kept his suggestion for the number of senators because it came with a classical precedent. The standard narrative is baffled by the mystery why the disinterested statesmen who rejected the New Jersey plan on June the 19th metamorphosed into the selfish partisans who approved an equal vote Senate on July 16th. In the traditionalist narrative which I'm presenting, the framers were not impervious to appeals for justice. They were sensitive to the rooted wisdom of the classical tradition. The history of the Philadelphia Convention and American history in general needs to be rewritten to show Americans time and again privileging biblical, classical, and English traditions over Enlightenment rationalism. Americans' rejection of tradition, which we've heard from de Crèvecoeur, D'Souza and Andrews appears again recently in Charles Murray's pamphlet, American Exceptionalism. At the founding, Murray writes, quotes, 4 million people founded a new nation from scratch, end quotes. For Murray, this is not a theory. Quotes, American exceptionalism is a fact of America's past, end quotes, recognized by European observers. Murray discusses it under four headings, industriousness, hard work, egalitarianism, religiosity, and community life, which he defines as, quotes, the odd combination of voluntarism, widespread charitable giving, and engagement in the community, end quotes. Let me discuss briefly the last 2 points. Religiosity appeals to Murray the libertarian. He writes, quotes, American churches have had to compete in the marketplace for adherents. And the result throughout our history has been a riotous variety of religions, many of them completely new sects, end quotes. Murray manages to discuss American piety, not religiosity, which means excessive piety, but still, he manages to discuss American piety without mentioning the Bible. He ignores the fact that most Americans base their religion on a 2,000-year-old book. For Murray's community life, I would prefer what I feel is a more accurate term, citizenship. Classical concept found in ancient Athens and Rome, as the founders knew. Cincinnatus and Livy Book III influenced those who read Latin, but also George Washington's Gary Wilson, in his excellent book, Cincinnatus, George Washington and the Enlightenment. The opposite of citizen is tyrant, an opposition basic to the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence, as Thomas Jefferson knew, even if contemporary scholars do not. America was exceptional, not because it created its government and way of life from scratch, but because it built directly on ancient traditions, as Samuel Huntington saw about religion. Let me quote from his Who Are We? This is about religion, it's parallel. Quotes, America was created as a Protestant society just as, and for some of the same reasons, Pakistan and Israel were created as Muslim and Jewish societies in the 20th century. Its Protestant origins make America unique among nations and help explain why, even in the 20th century, religion is central to American identity. America, said Tocqueville in an oft-quoted phrase, was born equal and hence did not have to become so. More significantly, America was born Protestant and did not have to become so. America was not founded, as Lewis Hart's argued, as a liberal Lockean or Enlightenment fragment of Europe. It was founded as a succession of Protestant fragments, process well underway in 1632. John Locke was born, end quotes. The Bible shaped the nation's religious life. Its secular political regime was based on the classical tradition, which preserved ancient ideas of republicanism, citizenship, tyranny, checks and balances, and other important political ideas and commitments. Of course, Americans instantiated these ideas and commitments in new American forms, but always rooted them in the classical tradition. Classical Christian education remained the educational gold standard from colonial schools and colleges until deep into the 20th century. As late as 1962, there were 728,600 Latin students in public high schools and many more in private and parochial schools. Charles Murray correctly points out that America's exceptionalism goes back to its origins and needs to be defended where it still exists and restored where it's decayed or disappeared in each generation. America's distinctive character cannot, however, be adequately described with sociological abstractions like religiosity and community life. We're talking about real historical traditions. Huntington is closer to the truth when he wrote, its Protestant origins make America unique among nations. But I would prefer to say its classical and Christian origins. What most Americans value about America, consensual institutions, rule of law, private property, science, faith, cannot survive without the ancient traditions that inspired and maintained them. The minister at Robert Frost Black Cottage had an insight we need to hear. Most of the change we think we see in life is due to truths being in and out of favor. As I sit here, and oftentimes, I wish I could be monarch of a desert land. I could devote and dedicate forever to the truths keep coming back and back to. I like Frost's poem. I have one quibble. Lands that are dedicated to the truths we keep coming back and back to are not deserts. They're full of family farms, local factories, and churches. Their families have a lot of children. Their citizens are also soldiers, like Cincinnatus. Their story is our story, a story that goes back to ancient Greece, Rome, and Israel. Today we like to proclaim nothing is the same after some important event. If we have to hear about the past, we want to lay it out for us in PowerPoint or download it onto our Kindle so we can skim it on the airplane. Give us the gist, and if you don't mind, spare us the history lesson. The founders, however, insisted on the history lesson, beginning with the Greeks, Romans, and Hebrews. We are free and creative, not because we inhabit a new nation dedicated to a proposition, but because we're citizens of what General MacArthur called it in his last speech at West Point, this beloved land of culture and ancient descent. John Adams wrote to his friend, the patriot Dr. Benjamin Rush, quotes, "I should as soon think of closing all my window shutters to enable me to see as banishing the classics to improve Republican ideas," end quotes. Today, as 200 years ago, we need to keep those window shutters open. We understand what Douglas MacArthur and John Adams were talking about.